Then there was an extradition, a hearing on extradition. And I did go on his behalf to speak to the Minister of Justice, and insisting that it was not an extraditable offense under the treaty. And went to see him in the jail, and it was pathetic. He was shackled. I mean, believe me, you don't want to go into one of those Israeli jails. He was, and in the interview he says to me, "I don't understand any of this," he said. "That stock came out at $8. It went to 60 or 70 or 80, whatever the number was. Nobody lost money." I said, "Eddie, and then it went to zero." Well, people were foolish and holding. I said, "Eddie, my wife, whom he liked, Linda, and her mother, and her brother, lost money. I'm sorry to hear that." I left him in the jail. I go out to the courtyard. I'm about to leave the premises. A guard comes running and says, "He wants to talk to you again." I go back to the door of the jail. And he says, "Justin, I promise you, if you get me out of this, I'll give Linda back her money." These guys are so unrealistic. I had I was also in the Franklin National Bank case, and then I was in the I had a witness in, what case was that? The Southern District. I represented a witness, Arthur Keller. It was Bob Garbage, something, I don't know. He had been the president of the Lincoln National Bank in Chicago. And you guys have a timetable?
No.
He was president of Lincoln National Bank in Chicago. And I don't know if it was some securities transactions. Hubert Humphrey had sent them to me because Hubert Humphrey knew that I was close to Bob Morgenthau, and he thought I'd be a good guy to represent him. And did you know a guy in the enforcement named Bloomberg? Well, you wouldn't have known him. He was in the New York office. Nice little guy. Very bright. And Bloomberg knew he was coming to see me, that Arthur Keller was coming to see me. And he called me. He said, "Justin, you can help him. I understand Keller's coming to see you. You can help him." And I said, "How can I help him?" He said, "Get him to tell you what he told the grand jury." He said, "He's been in the grand jury already?" He said, "Yes." Okay.
And how did Bloomberg know what he told the grand jury?
Bloomberg was on the staff of the commission. Yeah. And I guess working with the...
Supposedly, we're not supposed to get grand jury testimony.
Really? Well, he knew. The guy came to see me, and he told me this story about, fully innocent and so forth. And I said, "And who else have you told that story to?" He said, "Well, I told the grand jury." I said, "Well, why are you here?" Well, he said, "I'm not sure that the United States Attorney, the Assistant United States Attorney, buy the story, but it's true." I said, "Really?" I said, "In my experience, it wouldn't have happened that way." He said, "How would it have happened?" And I said, "I think more likely it would have happened this way." And I forget exactly the story. I laid it out. I remember he looked at me. He said, "So obvious." And I called Paul Grant, who was the assistant, and he became a government witness.
How would you, when you're counseling clients like Vesco or Antar, how would you describe the commission staff or the enforcement staff to them in terms of how tenacious they are or were, and how they, you know, what to watch out for and that kind of thing?
It's such an individual thing, Dan. I've got partners in this firm who are better than others. Not that all of them are very good. Some are better than others. And the same is true when an organization, you want to talk about tenacity. I've never met anybody like Alan Simpson. Never. On the Crazy Eddie case, he was...
Rick Simpson?
Rick Simpson. Rick Simpson. Excuse me, Alan Simpson, senator from Wyoming.
Yeah.
Rick Simpson. Tenacity? I'm telling you, when he wanted every dollar back, we had to fight with him to get 10 cents on the dollar on our fees. There are lazy guys, there are hard-working guys, there are smart guys, there are not-so-smart guys. In the Vesco case, Kushner is a smart guy, a good lawyer. Not in the courtroom. He didn't belong in that courtroom. He was outclassed in the courtroom. I like him. He's a good guy, I trust him. But give you an example. He wanted the testimony of the son of the president of Costa Rica to document that transaction. While we're saying he's in Costa Rica, you know, we don't control him. He's not our client. It turned out that Hyman gets a phone call from his office saying the guy's in his office. So we adjourn the hearing for the day. We go back and talk to the guy. We're not going to tell the court now that we can't produce him. We're going to have to tell the court he's in New York. And we tell him he's going to have to testify. And did we want him to testify? By no means. We went down to court the next day. We had him in tow. We had him in the courtroom. We disclosed to the court and to the commission's attorneys that the guy was there, that we had not expected him in town. And we found out yesterday that he was in town. We'd spoken to him. He's prepared to testify, but he's not prepared to talk to anybody before he takes his stand. And Kushner said, "What do you mean? I have to talk to him." We said, "He's not going to talk to you. He doesn't have to talk to you before he takes his stand." Kushner called Washington. They called Stanley. Stanley comes back. He says, "Stanley wants to talk to you." Stanley says, "Why won't you let him talk to him?" I said, "I'm not going to let him talk to him. Let me talk to Arthur. I'm not going to let him talk to him." He wants to put him on a stand. Put him on a stand. They didn't have the nerve to do it. It was just, they were out-lawyered.
Mm-hmm. How much of that is between you and the other lawyers you mentioned? There were probably another 20 associates working with you.
Yeah.
Kushner might have had one, maybe two other people.
No question. He did not have, he was not staffed the way he was staffed. He did not know the case the way we knew the case.
How big a problem is that? How do you, how does a government lawyer deal with that?
I don't know the answer to that. I think the answer has to be that when you see this happening, and the case is important enough to you, a case of the magnitude of the Vesco case, or the magnitude of some of these other cases you have going on now, you just have to staff it. Just have to staff it. You may even, in some instance, have to retain outside counsel. That's been done.
Has it? I'm not aware. When was that done? Do you know of
anything? I don't know if it's been done by the SEC.
We bring on consultants in cases where we need expertise.
Right, but it'll be an expert witness.
Correct.
Or we'll bring foreign counsel in another country.
Sure. But.
Well, didn't the Justice Department do it with Boyce in the Microsoft case?
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of it.
Yeah, I think other agencies, I know the banking regulators during the SNL scandal brought in private counsel.
It may be the thing to do on occasion. I'm not saying that, you know, the government counsel is never able to do it. It's not true. They are able to do it. Are they shorthanded? Yes. Are they inexperienced? Yes. Are they younger? Yes. Do they make up for it in enthusiasm and energy? Yes. And commitment? Sure.
I had a question about your perceptions of the staff as being fair. One of the things that that we're taught in the Division of Enforcement about our history and our legacy is that that it's very important to the integrity of our process that the defense bar and the people who are the subject of our proceedings perceive us as being fair. Do you have a view on that, and what has your experience been, particularly in the 1960s and 70s?
Particularly what?
Particularly in the 1960s and 70s.
As I think I said earlier, again, it depends on the people. I mean, it's all people. When I said to Stanley Sporkin, Stanley, you're not being fair. You become a cop. Step back for a minute. Think about it. He had sufficient respect for me based upon where we'd been in other cases so that he would say, do you really think so? And we talk about it. And I was either right or I was wrong, but he might modify his position somewhat, or I might modify mine. It is important that this, of course, at the bar, see the staff as being fair. But, you know, that's a two-way street. Not everybody in the bar will recognize that there's a tomorrow. I mean, my own view was definitely shaped in some measure by my association with Landis, who was very oriented toward the commission and its staff and its view. I was not, you know, I wasn't trying to take advantage of anybody. And I prided myself on the fact that people knew, or I thought they knew, hoped they knew, that if Justin Feldman said it was green, it was green. And if it didn't say it was green, he didn't say anything. Or he might tell you that you're colorblind, you ought to take another look at it, but he would not tell you it's green when it's red, and that's important as well. Now, I mean, there were shockers on the staff. There was an enforcement guy in the 60s. What the hell was his name? Oh, worked for Pollock. He was an investigator. He was the chief investigator.
Callahan?
No, the other name.
Yeagerman.
When Yeagerman had a bar meeting, when SEC speaks things or its equivalent, says to a group of us in the room, maybe 50, 60 lawyers, takes out a copy of the U.S. Code, and he says, this is a big book. It's got a lot of provisions. And if I'm out to get one of your guys and you're going to play around with me, if I don't get him on this, I'll get him on something else. It's a big book. Remember it. Well, we were so angry, everybody, that Ed Yeagerman, right?
Yes.
I mean, Yeagerman couldn't get the time of day from us after that. At least not from me. I wouldn't deal with him. He'd call me and say, I've got a case I want to talk to you about. I said, get somebody else in. I'm not talking to you. I'll never forget that meeting at which he said that. Have you heard about it?
I have not. That's very interesting.
He actually
had a copy of, not the USCA, you don't know, the government version of it. He lifted it up and said, it's a big book.
One of the things I've been curious about is today, the commission can get money penalties, can get officer and director bars. It's got a lot of remedies. Didn't have them in the 60s.
Right.
How do you think that's changed the way enforcement cases are?
I don't think it's changed it at all.
Really?
Not from my perception.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not involved, as you know now. You know, people are going to do what they're going to do. They think they'll get away with it. They think they're smart enough to get away with it. Whether it's a Kozlowski or somebody else or a Regas, I don't know. They'll take the shot. Plus the fact that your forfeitures, your disgorgement, it never touches it, really. How much do you, you know, What percentage on the dollar do you collect on your disgorgements and fines? I don't know.
Actually, it's probably 30-40%.
Is that high?
Yeah. It's actually a pretty good number. Remember, a lot of that though was settlements.
Now, do they credit for this in the class actions?
Quite often there is some that offset.
In the Arthur Anderson case, the penalty was against the SEC penalty was $7 million. But there had been a $75 or $80 million settlement in the class action that was taken into account.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think their fees were over the period of time?
At least commensurate with that, if not more.
You see, you've got two things going that bug me in the whole area now. One is, corporate officers get paid on the basis of the bottom line or the stock price. That's an incentive to steal. It really is. I'm not saying they all do it. They don't. But it's how you deal with it, I don't know. And the other is the whole structure in the legal and accounting profession. Years ago, a partner in a law firm, his first year as a partner, he got X percent, and his first 5 years, and the second 5 years, he got Y percent, and the third one, he got Z percent. Now, he eats what he kills. If he loses a client, he's losing money out of his pocket. I've sat on corporate boards and audit committees where I've seen auditors much too pliable. I'm not saying I've seen them commit fraud, but in the hope is that disclosure on derivatives, expensing of stock options, derivatives have driven me nuts. Nobody talks about exposure on derivatives. Nobody understands the derivatives in the first place. They're a creature of the computer. nobody could have conceived of these derivatives of a swap, short-term interest against long-term, or whatever would, you know, and the third race in Belmont. But I think the compensation question, whether it's corporate executives or lawyers or accountants, is a serious question. Now, Sarbanes-Oxley puts lawyers in a bind. I think too tight a bind in many ways. But their livelihood depends on, you got to go alone to get along.
Just maybe now would be a good time to talk about Chairman Landis, but I had one question just to maybe the place to start out is, what do you think that Chairman Landis's views of the Enron scandal and the scandals that have resulted in Sarbanes-Oxley, how he would have regarded these matters and the Commission's ability to deal with them?
That's so speculative. I think he would have considered it a challenge, whichever side of the matter he was on. I think he would think the commission is at a disadvantage in trying to deal with these matters, and I would guess that he would think Sarbanes-Oxley went too far.
Why? In which regard?
Putting the lawyers into the mix. Making them policemen.
In terms of the reporting provisions that they have to observe.
Right. I think he would have worried about that.
Had the gatekeeper or access theory been something that had been articulated prior to the sort of Stanley Sporkin or Pollock era in any way that you recall?
No, I don't think prior to the Stanley Sporkin or Pollock era, you had only the outrageous cases. Landis used to like to talk about the Jones case, you know, being the first.
The Edward Jones case.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The first, you know. And talked about how he wrote the 10b-5 regulation to fit the case when they said they didn't have, wasn't that the first criminal prosecution? The Edward Jones?
That was the case that went up to the Supreme Court.
Right.
But I don't recall it being in criminal.
Oh.
It was the oil royalties case.
And 10b-5 came a few years after
1942.
Yeah. But I recall his saying that he that during the course of the proceeding he went and scratched out the regulation because there was no regulation under 10b of the Act.
I heard that the act itself
was too vague.
Many people, I think Milt Friedman also claimed that he wrote the first draft of it.
Well, he may have been in on it. Milt Friedman was also in the Vesco case.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. It was funny how that came about. We were in the Grosvenor Hotel in London. A whole bunch of us meeting with Vesco, some of the other principals. And we had concluded that somebody there needed independent counsel. And we were going to think about who it should be. And we went down to the lobby, and Milt Friedman was sitting in the lobby claiming to be there on another matter, and of course he was retained immediately, and none of us were ever sure somebody had asked him to be there or whether he was there, whether it was pure serendipitous. The character, great character. Did you know him either of you?
Well, he was at Arnold and Porter.
Oh, sure.
And apparently he gave a very nice oral history at Arnold and Porter about his experiences in working on 10B5.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I met him, I was probably a very young child.
Is he still alive?
I don't know.
No, he passed away. He passed away about 5 or 10 years ago.
I must be one of the last survivors. I was younger than most of those guys.
How did you first meet Landis?
I met him, as I started to say earlier, when I was renting space from George Brenner. I was a single practitioner. And Brenner had space, and I rented one of these arrangements where I got services and space for a couple $100 a month at that time. And Brenner had latched on to Landis in the Westchester political arena when Landis was supervisor of the town of Harrison.
Was that just a part-time job or something?
Yeah, it was part-time. He attacked it with great enthusiasm. Anyway, and Brenner had been a candidate, Democratic candidate for Congress, and then Democratic. Then he had been appointed by Harriman as a surrogate when the surrogate or probate judge died. And they had formed a firm in Westchester. And I, when Brenner asked me to join his New York firm, I said I would only do it if Landis was in the New York firm, and he brought him in. Brenner later lasted about 2 years with us when he tried to commit suicide, and it turned out that, and then he was indicted for fraud. He had overextended himself financially when he ran for office. He bought an interest in a hotel, but he had a lot of stock in the First National Bank in Yonkers, and he hopped the stock in 3 different places, same certificate numbers, and that was the end of Brenner. So he was in the firm, out of the firm by December 31 of 58. And then Landis and I continued until he died.
What were Landis's work habits like during the time that you and he were partners?
Very erratic. Very frustrating. If he had something challenging to do, that's too general. He would drive you crazy. He would say, you'd give him a draft of a brief to look at, and it was due in 2 days. And he wouldn't look at it. And he'd go to lunch, and he'd come back sloshed. And he wouldn't look at it. And he'd go home about 4 o'clock. And you'd call him 7 o'clock, ask him if he'd looked at it. He said, I'll get to it. And he would walk in at 10 o'clock the next morning with a total revision that sang. That's the way he did the report, too.
When we looked at it, Dan noticed that the report was basically done in, what, about 6 or 8 weeks?
Yes.
How was that possible?
Yes.
The president announced on the morning after Election Day his first two appointments, President Kennedy, in November of 1960. The first was to reappoint J. Edgar Hoover, and the second was to name Jim Landis to do a survey of the regulatory agencies and a proposal. The Kennedy family had in mind getting Jim on the Supreme Court. Jim on the Supreme Court. Without having said so. But that Wednesday, when it was announced, we talked about it. We called the guys in Washington who he was loosely affiliated with. We asked them to get us some space. They got us a house on F Street that was available. I don't know why it was available. A whole house. And he and I went down to Washington.
All right.
Okay?
Yep.
Anyway, we went down to Washington. Someone introduced us. Somebody volunteered. I don't know where he came from. To a young, then young lawyer named Mitchell Cutler.
Okay.
And essentially, what we did was call in to visit with us. Heads of the, I guess there were eight agencies at the time. Or at least people from the agencies who we felt would be constructive. We called in hearing examiners. We called in enforcement people, economists. Variety of staff people. See, there were, the ICC, CAB, SEC, there were seven agencies, huh? I don't know why I thought there were eight. Well, I guess, what do you have in other, what do you have in other regulatory agencies? Page 65? I don't know. Be that as it may, we would speak to the various people in various phases of the work of the agencies. The policy people, the administrative people, the adjudicatory people, the rulemaking people, and try to get a sense of what was going on. In fact, Jim, in his inimitable way, had a pretty good sense of what was going on in all of those agencies. He asked questions. I took notes. We had Cutler go get copies of annual reports, recent cases, newspaper clippings that are relevant to whatever the material might be. And that went on for several weeks. And I was staying, I think, at the Hay Adams. I forget where Jim was staying. He may have been at been there too. In any event, we'd have lunch, most of our meals at the little French restaurant at the corner of what was then the corner of, at the corner of Rhode Island and Connecticut, or M in Connecticut, where they intersect, which is now a big office building with Steptoe and Johnson as its office. We'd go back after dinner and break up around 10 or 11 o'clock at night and gather again at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know where it came from, but he would go home and scribble longhand. He would take my notes, he would take the material that Cutler had assembled. He would come back the next morning he would have somebody type up what he had scribbled. He'd show it to me and ask me what I thought. And in most instances, I was just aghast. I was amazed. I mean, I wouldn't have changed a comma. I couldn't have synthesized what we'd heard, what we'd seen, what we'd learned in the way he had done it. But he really did it over the period of the last week. During the course of the time we were there, the president-elect announced that Bobby was going to be his attorney general. And while we were there one day, the attorney general designee, whichever it is, came over to F Street. I'd known him from the prior dealings with the family and from the campaign, and he asked me to excuse myself, and I did. He was in the room with Landis for about a half hour, and he left. And I said, "Can you tell me what that was about?" And he laughed, and he said, "It was about nothing." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "He's on his way over to the Supreme Court to see Bill Douglas and to offer him the ambassadorship to India in the hope that he would take it and that I could go on court." I said, "Well, what do you mean it's nothing?" And he said, "Well, number one, he's not going to take it, particularly if he thought I was going to go on the court. They did not get along well with the commission. And I'm never, ever going to put myself in front of a Senate committee."
"Why?"
"For confirmation."
"Why? He'd done it before."
I said, "Why?" "Wouldn't tell me. I learned it later, but wouldn't tell me. Just said I'd never do it. Never do it. I thought it was because of his drinking habits that he would never do it. Because of his amorous habits that he would never do it. All of which were well known." But that was that conversation. Later on, while we were there, Felix Frankfurter, with whom he had not been gotten along in some time, because Felix was very friendly with his first wife and was angry at Jim for having divorced his first wife and run off with his secretary and, quote, dishonored the Harvard Law School while he was dean. And Felix had been ill, and there was a lot of speculation as to whether he would get off or wouldn't get off or when he would get off. And Felix somehow or other knew the story of the Bill Douglas story, whether Douglas had told him or how he knew, we didn't know.
Well, just for context, the story meaning that Landis had delayed his departure to Harvard?
No.
No, the story about the appointment.
Douglas. Which one are you talking about?
I'm talking in the 30s when Douglas was going to ascend to the chairmanship, and Landis had been chairman and delayed his departure.
Yes, because he did not want Douglas to be chairman.
Right, and Douglas didn't forgive him because of...
Douglas didn't forgive him, and he never thought Douglas was up to the job. And but anyway, Frankfurter said that he had heard the story and that if there was a commitment from the Kennedys to give it to Jim, he would get off the court now. And Jim again said he's not going to subject himself to this, to the confirmation process. And that was the end of it for that period of time. In any event, he finished the report. We finished the report. I like to say. We then got involved in the staffing issues for the agencies. We then found there was no money with which to print the report. So the law firm laid out the money to print it. It was printed by Ad Press, which did our brief printing for us. It was later printed, I think, by one of the congressional committees. And the reason I said something about the Federal Power Commission was that the one of the Senate committees, chaired by Everett Dirksen at the time, held a hearing on the report. Whether it was before the inauguration or after the inauguration, I'm not certain. But he started to take Jim through the various recommendations, kind of skeptically. And they were friendly. And he finally said, Dean Landis, the one I don't understand is the Power Commission, the Federal Power Commission. Why do they have to have these long, drawn-out, dull, adjudicatory hearings that take forever? The staff reviews these applications for rate changes. The staff then takes a position. They hold these hearings before a hearing examiner. They go on interminably. And particularly in this day and age, and I'm not talking the end of 60, beginning of 61, not where we are now, with computers. Why can't they put all of that economic data into a computer and have a rate structure come out? And Jim broke up the Senate committee by saying, I'll never forget it, he said, well, Senator, let me just tell you that I recently heard from my friends at the CAB that American Airlines had developed a new fully automated aircraft and that some people were on it just the other day, and the pilot's voice came over the public address system and said, ladies and gentlemen, you are on a historic flight. This flight is totally automated. There is no pilot aboard, and it will be flown entirely on automatic pilot. As a consequence, there is no chance for human error, human error, human error, human error. He said, Senator, we're not there. I'll never forget. He just, you know, spontaneously. So,
in terms of writing something like this in that short period of time, how much of this do you think that Dean Landis and or you sort of knew going in what these issues were, and is really a question of just confirming that?
I certainly did not know. I knew some of the issues at the SEC. I did not at the other agencies. He did. Mm-hmm. A lot of it. I mean, he knew what to ask. He was prepared. He was persuaded that the ICC, which was the first of the regulatory agencies, having been created, what, in 1890-something, was a total anachronism and useless. He knew that the hearing examiner problem was a serious problem. We did not have expertise in the particular jurisdiction of the commission for which they sat, and that you needed to increase their prestige, and you needed to create their expertise. He knew that in the case of the SEC that you had to delegate, that you just could not go on with this ridiculous notion of going to the commission with evidentiary rulings in the course of a hearing. I knew that. And some of these things, and What he did not know is how strongly the communication lobby would be, because that was the one reorganization plan that failed, the FCC. But he was quite knowledgeable. But I had been chair of the Administrative Law Committee of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, and so I, from 57 to 60, and in that capacity, learned an awful lot about the various agencies. Believe it or not, the Association of the Bar of the City of New York at that point did not have a Committee on Securities Regulation. So the issues of securities regulation were covered by the Committee on Administrative Law, and of course one of the recommendations that I made at the end of my term there was to create a Committee on Securities Regulation. But of all the bar associations in the world, so we've come a long way since then. We talked before about the Sidney Tagger case, which I've forgotten about. I represent